Jetson and to move off of Handy's. It looked like Zeus was on top of Olympus and like throwing lightning bolts, you know, do not come up here. You know, I dare you. And so
I got too many miles to go. I'm just an old hard rocker running from the dust till dawn. Yeah, I'm just a midnight walker, wondering what's it taking so long. When the sun goes down, that's when I'll sing my.
Hey everybody, my name's Dan Ryan. I am the social media director for the Hard Rock 100 Endurance Run. I'm joined today by Chris Twiggs, co-host of the Hard Talk podcast, and Jeff Browning.
I'm Chris Twiggs, 16-time Hard Rock finisher, Run Committee member, and man without a title. I'm really excited that we have Jeff Browning on with us. Jeff has 7 Hard Rock finishes. His fastest Hard Rock finish was in 2016 with a 25:42, and he has finished first in 2018. He was our Hard Rock champion. Excited to see him back there again this year, where he was the 5th male. Jeff, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks, guys. Great to be on.
So we've been asking an icebreaker question to everyone we've had on so far, which is just one person, and we've already tweaked the question. So the question is, what was the first shoe you ran in, and what year was that?
Oh, man, that is going to go way back. That would be 2000. First shoe I ran in trails or first shoe I ran in roads? You know, I mean, I ran in like some, you know, like really cheap on sale trail shoes in my early days. But when I started getting into ultra running in 2001 was my first 50K at the beginning of 2001. But I was running in one in the year 2000. I was running in, if you can remember the North Face Ultra 100, it was their early gray, black, and yellow. I got that at the North Face outlet in Bend, Oregon. And then I also bought the Montrail Diaz Vista, if you guys remember that. And the, trying to think of the other, Leona Divide, the Montrail Leona Divide. Those were the two first two, and the Diablo were the first three kind of Montrail shoes that I kind of did trail running in and started doing ultras in. By the time I did, in 2002, I ran my first 100 at Western States. I ran in the Montrail Diaz Vista. We used to, me and a buddy, Rod Bean, used to call it the Diaz Slicker, because the tread wasn't that great on it, and it sometimes lost a pod or two, and then it would get really slippery if it lost a piece of the tread, and it would just be the EVA showing. And so, like, sometimes tail end of the race, you'd be like, why am I slipping? And you look down, and you're like, oh, my tread is missing. That was one of those early Montrails were actually not bad. They were kind of based more on a road shoe design. At least the Diaz Vista and the Diablo were lighter. They were kind of cool early prototype trail running shoes. I really loved the Scree sock on the Diablo. That became my favorite shoe. I raced in that one for a lot of years. Was on the Montrail Patagonia team up until from 03 through 05. And then Columbia bought out Montrail, and the Montrail Patagonia team fell apart. And then I was on the Patagonia team from that point forward. So I kind of ran in whatever I wanted after that.
Yeah. Nice. I went to, after my first failed trail shoes, I went to the Leona Divide and ran in those for quite a while. Those were a good shoe. Montrail did. Yeah. That's some great,
I finished
great,
a lot
great
of
products.
Hundreds in the Leona Divide.
Yeah. Yeah. Great product. So you finished a lot of hundreds, period. Yep. But I'm really interested in knowing, and you know, this podcast, obviously we're focused on Hard Rock. We would love to know what first attracted to you and made you sign up for that first Hard Rock.
Well, I had gone to Bighorn in 05 and then in 06, and I camped next to Rock Horton, and, Rock and I think we met at 04, I'm pretty sure we met at 2004 at Wasatch. He paced Chrissy Mayle. She was like the sixth female to go sub 24 on that course. Mm-hmm. And I had run sub 24. I got fifth that year. And I think Chrissy got sixth. And so we had both, we were like 20 minutes apart at the end. And I was, she wasn't that far back. And Rock had paced her. And so Rock and I kind of befriended each other at Wasatch. And then we camped next to each other in 05 at Bighorn. And we came back and we're both ran it both years in 06 as well. And he's the one that told me about Hard Rock. And, you know, he was in the middle of his, you know, 10 finishes, going towards his 10 finishes. And so in 07, I flew to Salt Lake and rode with Rock over to Silverton and ran my first Hard Rock. And he wrote me into playing guitar in the gym after the race when I'd been up for, you know, 30 some hours and had Hard Rock on my legs. I botched my solo on the guitar. It was awesome. I had the rhythm down and the harmonizing on the chorus, but I botched my solo, man.
Yeah. Everybody listening, that is Jeff Browning singing in the old Hard Rocker song that we play, or playing guitar in the old Hard Rocker song, that you guys heard as our intro here.
There you go.
Those concerts could be kind of rough on Sundays in the gym after we'd all run.
Yeah, I think the 25th anniversary or whatever we did, 2018, was that 25th? 2018, is that right?
Sounds right. Yeah, yes, I think so. Silver. Yeah.
Rock and I did. He had another song he'd written, and we did a different version, like a similar version, but we did. He had written another song. It was in the same vein, but it was a different style. It was more bluesy with his dobro instead of bluegrassy. So we put that together really quickly right before but we got to play that at pre-race check-in when we were fresh. So that was a much stronger performance than the 2007 performance. So that was fun.
What was the most surprising thing about Hard Rock your first time when you got there?
It slapped me in the face. I had slept in an altitude tent for 4 weeks. I lived at 3,500 feet. I had never been to Silverton. I'd never been on the Hard Rock course and not stepped one foot on it. I came in on Wednesday or Thursday, I can't remember. So right before the race, and showed up. And that was the year Scott Jurek ran the record in the counterclockwise direction. I think at the time it was like 26 something. It's crazy how much that course record's come down since then. Carl chased him and I went out in third. Mark Hartel and I went out in third, fourth. And we were, I kind of had a little bit of an ego in 07 because I'd won Bighorn 2 years in a row and got the course record of Bighorn in 06. So I come in 07 with 200 wins thinking I'm kind of a cool dude. And I was young and, you know, early 30s. And I show up to Hard Rock thinking I can compete with Jurek and Carl. And I go out hard. And everyone knows don't go out hard at Hard Rock. But I went out hard. I came into Cunningham at mile 9. And Mark Hartile and I were kind of trading the third, fourth on the way down into Cunningham on coming off Little Giant. And I got in there, and when I crewed there, my right leg was like Elvis. It was like shaking. And, you know, and I was like, ooh, that's not good. I had not done enough vert. I was not ready for that race. I had no idea what I was getting into. I ended up blowing up after handies, and a bunch of veterans were going by me on going up engineer and just going, how you doing, buddy? Hang in there. And I was hurting. And then what else happened? I learned a lot at that race. Jason Koop 20-something Jason Koop, was pacing me, new employee at CTS, I think at the time, or really new. And he was he wanted to understand ultras, and he'd never been to 100. I think it was his first time in 100, if I recall correctly. And he paced me. I met him through Garrett Grobbins, just on email. He paced me from Ouray to Telluride. I was falling asleep on my feet. Chrissy and Darcy passed me on that section, and Chrissy went on to the course record. I was falling asleep on my feet. I was hypoxic. Didn't know what hypoxia was at the time, but I now, in hindsight, know exactly what was going on. I'm sure my O2 sat level was like 81 or something. And I went on, and they would, and back then it was hardcore at the aid stations too. Like, I was at Telluride and I was falling asleep on my feet. I just wanted a nap, and they would not let me take a nap. They were like, nope, get out of here. And I was like, I just want to sleep for like 10, 15 minutes. And they're like, nope. And they pushed me out, and it took me like 5 hours to go the 9 miles over to Chapman, falling asleep on my feet, you know, like didn't have enough layers. I was freezing, and I got over to Chapman before dawn and slept for 45 minutes, just sitting in a chair. I just sat in a chair, like my head bobbing around with like, they threw a blanket over me. I chugged some soup, and I crashed out 45 minutes, woke up. It was light out. I was like, how long have I been sitting here? And they go, oh, about 45 minutes. I got to get out of here. And so I like stumbled out of there and finally got moving again, and finished in 33:18. I learned a lot about altitude, you know, the hard way in that race. I also learned that you could take a nap and come back. That was a good little lesson. You know, I've never had to do that again in 100, but at the time it was always a fallback plan after that experience. And I also learned not to go out hard. That was a good lesson. And that became my race strategy for the next, you know, 15, 20 years of, you know, that was my 500. So like, I was not gonna make any stupid mistakes after that. So I always went out easier, respected the course, especially Hard Rock. And that's kind of, there was a lot of lessons learned at that race. It was one of the first like big lessons learned.
Yeah. I mean, that's a perfect first Hard Rock experience, right? You got it all the way around. You got to kiss the rock, but yep, the rock also beat you up a little bit.
Really good. It beat me up.
Now, so what made you, now it took you till 2014 before you got back in. What made you decide you wanted to come back?
Well, I had a bucket list of races that I wanted to do. And I still was focused on Bighorn. I went back to Bighorn a couple more times. You know, and I was really focused back then until I 01 to 07, I was focused on, or 01 to 06, I was focused on one 100 a year. In 07, when I did Hard Rock, I started focusing on two 100s a year, kind of spread out. So I did Hard Rock that year. And then I did like Arkansas Traveler in October. And then after that, I started doing two 100s a year for a lot of years. Was kind of focused on that until 2014. I got into Hard Rock. It got hard to get back in after a while. When about the time I started to say, you know what, I kind of want to do it again, like second chance, you know, it was far enough removed my memory that I was like, I was like, I need to go back to that race.
The pain was gone. And
yeah, exactly. And I had more experience, and I was like, okay. And at that point, I don't remember how many hundreds I'd finished at that point, but you know, I think I was over 10 when I started entering it again. And I was like, you know, I kind of want to do it again, but then it was harder to get in. So I missed the lottery a couple years, you know, just didn't get in. And then in 14, I finally got in, and that's when I decided in 2014, I started doing four 100s a year from 14 on, and four to five. I'd decide on every year, and sometimes I'd maybe only get three if I had a little injury or niggle or something where I'd have to like, you know, back out of one of them. But I tried to put four on my schedule every year starting in 2014. And so 14 was kind of my year of trying that for the first time, and I got into Hard Rock. But I wanted to do other stuff too. So I'd like kind of put other things on my schedule I, you know, I think I did Zion 100 that year as a lead up race to Hard Rock, as just an early season kind of trainer, just to get that 100 in my head again, because I was so, I really respected Hard Rock after that. Like I was like, I'm not going to be stupid. I'm going to run smart. You know, like I need to be really ready for vert, you know? So I trained a ton of vert after Zion, and I recovered from Zion, and I really focused on vert that year. And I did some other shorter 50K, 50 mile, I think, training races for that in the lead up. I might have done Silver State 50 miler or something that year. It has a decent amount of vert. So I really focused on specificity coming into Hard Rock that year. And then after that, you know, I think I started getting back in because they kind of redid the lottery into the bucket, three bucket system back then instead of the two bucket that it is now. But, and then after being a veteran, you know, with finishes, I got in easier after that.
So the number four question that we asked him was, we talked about tech, a little bit of tech, right? So what was the flashlight situation like in 1993, right? And he was like, it was terrible. There was, you know, you couldn't see. He goes, I turned my light off and was walking up Camp Bird Road. And he goes, and I decided to turn it on, and I was like one step from falling off the side. And do you have any stories like that of like the gear changing over the years? Right, because now we've got these stadium lighting around our waist.
Yeah, we look like a 747 coming down the trail. You know, I wear a waist lamp and a headlamp, you know. You know, you're pushing like 400 or 500 lumens on medium. And it's just like so different. I really started, though, I can't even remember. I think I was using a Black Diamond headlamp in 07 because of my relationship with Rock, and Rock worked at Black Diamond. So I had at least a nice headlamp. Actually, you know what? I had a double light. We had Rock and I had like put our heads together, and I was lacing two headbands because the headbands used to be a lot smaller. I had put two headbands laced together with a headlamp around my waist and a headlamp around my head. So I had double lights in 05, 06 at Bighorn. And that was me like geeking out with Rock over like lighting, because I've always been kind of a technical, you know, being a graphic designer automatically makes you, being a creative person makes you like rethink everything. Like, can I cut something off? Can I tweak this piece of gear to fit my purposes better? How could I improve this? You know, this is what I need. And that was my intro to dealing, or me personally starting to talk to brands or people at brands that made product that was like, hey, we could make that. This would be cooler if it was like this, you know? And Black Diamond actually switched some of their bands to like expand wider after that. So I didn't have to lace two bands together, and I could just open it all the way up and put it around, step through it and put it around my waist. And now I have Ultraspire stuff, and they make a specific waistband one. Right. So, anyway, point being, the lights have come a long way. I think my lights were okay back then. I think there were maybe 200 to 300 lumens. They weren't huge, but the lights switched a lot from like 02 to 05. Like, I remember Western States was horrible. 02 running Western States, the lights sucked. I had like a weird handheld one I had rigged onto my handheld, like a pistol. And then I had that, but I had to run with my hand, you know, like pointing at the trail. And then I had a headlamp on, and they were really dim. You could not see jack. Like, you had to slow way down at night. You can see why the 100 mile times, one of the reasons the 100 mile times were so slow back then is that you, once it got night, you had to slow way down on the downhills because you just couldn't see anything. It was like very dim. But then they really improved, like, from like when we went into like the LED technology started showing up, and we started really like in 04, 05, like things really changed. And it was cool to be on the pioneering end of that, because all of a sudden I had this light setup that no one else had, because I had double lights. And at Bighorn, you know, it back then, and now it starts at like 9 in the morning, but back then it started at 11 in the morning. So you had to run all the way through the night, even in the front. And so I remember just being able to hammer at night with these nice lights, I could see the trail, and I could see I could see the technical aspect of the trail too, because if you timed your lights to be right, you know, like your waist lamp was mainly in front of you and your headlamp was pointing way out, so you could see flags and, you know, head on a swivel, you'd get, you know, shadows off the backside of obstacles, so you could really see roots and rocks. And then all of a sudden, if your brain can like see them, right, if your eyes can see the shadows and the shape of everything in front of you, you can actually run fast. So, so that was kind of a cool aspect. Now, other gear that hadn't quite caught up yet, even up until 2014, maybe in Europe by that time, but we didn't have access to that gear yet. But like, at least I didn't know of it. I was wearing, like, in that 2014 was that crazy year where the storm hit Friday night, where it rained all night. That was like the lightning. We got pinned down. Coop and I, here's Coop again. Coop and I got pinned down in Kaburagi and Diana Finkel. We all got pinned down in American Basin when the storm hit, with lightning hitting everywhere around us, pouring down rain. And I had two Houdinis. I had like a Houdini pullover and a Houdini zip. So they had made a pullover that didn't have a hood, and then they made a zip. I had double that on, and I had Houdini pants. So, but they weren't waterproof, right? They were water resistant, but we didn't have like really nice gear yet. You know, enough Americans hadn't really been going to UTMB and then asking sponsors for like, hey, I need tape seams and waterproof, you know, pants, jacket, and I need it light and packable, right? So that was just the beginning of that gear getting rolling with that UTMB influence, where we all were going over, and like, then we're like, well, all our brands still have backpacking waterproof gear. So it was like it was like barely packable. It was gigantic. You had to have a huge pack to fit it all, you know, when you had a required kit at UTMB. And so that really drove like the kits becoming smaller and smaller and packable and more packable. And now they're super light, right? I mean, I think my pants, waterproof pants, are like 3.5 ounces, and my jacket's like 4.5 ounces or something, you know, with a hood. So like, things are way lighter than they used to be. And the gear's come a long way just in the last decade.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, the changes have been incredible, and people are using different gear. A lot more people, even at the front, are using poles that didn't used to use poles. The vests have come a long way. Lots of important changes that have made things a little bit easier. People like Dan, they just don't know how easy they've got it, really. So you had the honor, well, you earned it, of being the champion in 2018, being the first hard rocker to kiss the rock in 2018. And we would just love to hear what that experience was like for you coming in and kissing that rock and all of that whole run. It was an interesting year, not without its drama, but with, you know, you didn't really know a lot of that drama as it was going on. Would love to hear your story of that 2018
run. Drama until 9 miles to go.
Yeah.
Had no
clue.
I was in second place the whole time. Xavier was in the lead, you know, and I got turned around. This was another lesson. I learned a lot of lessons at Hard Rock. Another lesson was, you know, carry your phone with GPS on it, because, or at least on your watch, because, and that was before the watch technology had really caught up, right, as far as mapping goes and GPX routes. But I did have it on my phone, and I remember looking at my phone before the race and going, I'm not going to carry the weight. And it was where the Beaver Dam is when you come out of Sherman, and there was that new Beaver Dam, was all brand new, and the course would look different. You went down in the willows, and you kind of had to go above the Beaver Dam and then go across, and then you had to like come back before you climbed out of the creek. And it was really, it turned me around, and it was in the middle of the night. And I climbed up off the creek, and I did the long, 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 long climb, and I didn't see a flag, and I didn't see a flag. And then I started getting freaking out. And I was like, and you know, Charlie was still the course director, so there were hardly any flags. And so no flag. And I'm going for a long time. And it's, you're at 12,000 feet, you're climbing. And I'm just like, oh, I got to turn around. You know, I got to that point where you came to that like moment of like truth. You're like, this isn't worth continuing unless you know you're on the course. So I turn around, I run back downhill, and I looked on, you know, Strava afterwards, and I think it was about an hour detour, you know, with running back down, I ran all the way back down to the creek, was standing on a boulder, found the last flag was at as you came out of the creek. So I'm standing there on a boulder, and I see third place, who I had an hour lead on over, was coming up the creek with his pacer on the other. He still had to go above the beaver dam. And I yelled across to him, and they yelled back to me, and then I was like, dang it. Okay, I'm on course. So that was my realization that I was right. And then I had to backtrack everything I just did back uphill. And I finally got back to kind of the point I remember turning around, and literally another 100 or 200 yards, there was one flag. So had I gone another couple hundred yards, there would have been a flag reassuring me. But, you know, back then they were way few and far between. And so that was a good lesson. You know, I was like, carry your stupid phone at Hard Rock, especially if Charlie's marking the course. And it was kind of crazy. So that moment, I'm in second, right? I'm thinking Xavier's got a good lead. I'm not going to catch him. But now I'm like, I've jeopardized my second place, right? And Troy Howard was in third at that point. I didn't even know Jeff Rome was charging at this point. So I am running everything in Pole Creek I possibly can, pushing up over to Maggie, climbing out of Maggie. I remember looking at my watch and then watching as lights were coming down into Maggie. So I could see when they got to the aid station, I was like, okay, this is how far behind they are, you know? And I think I had maybe 12 minutes on Troy Howard, but Jeff Rome's light was coming down. I still remember Troy and his pacer's lights. And then I saw this light coming down, like someone was like running a lot faster on the downhill. Like it was like one of those things where in your head you go, when I stood there, you know, covered up my light and I was watching everybody come down, he was definitely moving faster. And I was thinking, well, maybe that's someone just checking the course, you know, out running on the course, cause that's coming down pretty fast. So I just kept plugging away, and I get down into Cunningham, and I come down on that last switchback before you drop down to the road when you come out of the cliff band, and Paul Nelson's standing there. It's dawn. And Paul, you know, so I'm an hour later than I should have been. I should have been coming through there in the dark. I was on my way because I was doing the double again that year. And I remember thinking I was ahead of my splits from 16, like to get the double record again. So I was going to get my own double record I was thinking 20 to 30 minutes. So I was going to run quite a bit faster at Hard Rock that year. I was on pace for about a 20, maybe a 25, 15. It was low 25. So I didn't think I was going to be able to get under 25, but I was trying to get low 25. I ended up running like a 26:20 that year, but that was because of the detour, right? Our detour.
Right.
So I'm coming in and I'm like, right when I hit that switchback, Paul goes, I'm not supposed to tell you, but you're in the lead. And I was like, what? What happened to Xavier? And he's like, he got DQ'd. And I'm already by him. Right. So I'm running down the road and then I'm like, I've got the 50 yards or whatever it is to get over to the aid station or 60 yards running down the road for this to soak in that you're in the lead at Hard Rock. Right. I don't know what happened to Xavier, but all I know is he's DQ'd. I don't know why. I don't know how. I just know that I'm in the lead and I have to like fix my head. Like, I'm like, okay. So the first thing I did was like, you're in the freaking lead, dude. Do not blow this. So I come in there and I'm already in that 50 yards, have already gone through all that. And I've already made a plan for my crew for what I need. You know, like I need to get rid of weight. I need just two bottles and one gel to get me to the finish line. And, you know, and then I needed gloves because of the downhill, you know, because of 2016, I'd hammered that last downhill for the double record in that direction. And you know where there's that slabby section when you first come off Little Giant and you go across the Scree and you come down, there's a really big slabby section where there's a lot of ball bearing rocks. It's maybe 10 meters.
Oh yeah.
It's a sucky section. But I remember that section being sketchy and I just thought I need gloves for that section so I can slide it.
Good, smart, yeah.
And so I get in there and I'm like flipping things out of my pop of my pack. I had a top load pack at that time. Flipping things out of the pack, getting all the weight out, you know, all the layers, lights off, you know? And I was like, I need gloves. And my crew dude was like, dude, they're wet and they're in the truck. And because I'd wore them all night, right? They're all sweaty and gross. And And he didn't bring them because he thought I didn't need them, right? And so I can't even recall who it was, but someone was working the aid station, a woman, and her husband was in the race. She might have been working the aid station. She might have been crew. I don't remember. But she gave me her husband's gloves because he was in the race. So she just goes, I've got these gloves. And they were like the old school, like slip-ons that have the little dots all over them, you know, for grip. You know, they're just the little fabric ones. But they were like older and they'd been used. And so I like threw, I'm like, sure, I'll take them. Boom, boom, thank you. You know, and like, I'm out of there and I'm running everything. I like all fatigue is gone, you know, from adrenaline. And it's like, I ran across, ran up, you know, we had, that's when they had the log bridge before it got washed out. So I went across the log bridge, head up that climb. I was running, 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 everything you can see before you go into the trees. You know, until I got to the trees and I was like, oh, okay, like I pulls out, you know, just going, you're in the lead, Hard Rock Bronco. Come on. You know, like, do not blow this, you know? And so then I come out and I think Troy Howard's behind me. Okay. So you get up Little Giant where it gets up through that, where there's a little waterfall and you're to the right of it and switchbacking up and you can see back down on the course. And then you go out. It's like a, it's that first like kind of false summit you go over that you can't, you're looking up and you can't, once you go over it, you can't see down. But I was right at the top of that. And I remember looking down and I could see, now in hindsight, it was Jeff Rome, but I thought it was Troy Howard. And so like, all I can see is he's like, whoo, whoo, whoo. And I'm going whoo, whoo with my poles. And I'm like, I think he's moving faster than me, you know? And so I'm just freaking out. And what's funny, so I think he was like 6 minutes behind me or something at Cunningham.
Wow.
So he was close. And so I just remember like just breathing like you were doing intervals, you know, type of effort all the way to the top of Little Giant. And I remember thinking when I was polling, like when I get to the top, I got to get down to the trees and the road before he comes over the top. So it just mentally deflates him, you know, like when he comes over the top and looks over the edge, you know, cause you gotta do a little traverse right. And then you gotta let, and then you really drop it and you can see the whole downhill down to the road by the mine. And I was like, I just got to get there. And then he'll come over and look and he'll go, oh, where'd he go? So I'm just hammering, man, putting my poles away, like to the edge. Huck off that edge. I'm just reckless abandon down across the scree, hit that 10 meter slab. I literally slid like a crab slide with my feet, you know, feet and hands on the ground behind me. I slid that section. I had holes in the gloves that lady gave me. Like I ripped holes in them. I was like, shh, came up running and like all the way down. And then I like stopped right at the trees and I looked up. And I followed the whole trail and I didn't see him. I was like, sweet. And then I just took off down the road as hard as I could, you know? And I had the confidence from 2016, I'd hammered that downhill, the whole road, all of it hard, trying to like knock the double record down. And I just had run that road really fast. And so I just got in that mode and just like, you've done this before. Come on, boom. And you're like, if you run this fast, he's got to run this fast, you know? And so I'm just hammering down the road. I remember getting down near where you have to come down and do all the little switchbacks down to the creek and cross the creek at that little pipeline. And I was on the gravel road and it's all gnarly gravel, right? It's big boulders. And like every year is different, like depending on the weather and all that the year before and the winter. And there was a bunch of big, you know, giant rocks all over the place. And I was trying to take a gel. And I remember thinking like, this is going to be your last gel. Probably you have to take maybe one more, you know? And so I think, or maybe I only had one gel. I think I only got one gel at that aid station. So it was like, okay, strategic, like halfway through the section, take a gel. And so I'm messing with the gel and I kick a rock and I do a literal body slam in the gravel road on my left quad. And my quad, the fascia was numb for like, I hit so hard that like it did some like, you know, where you look like you have kind of have road rash a little bit, but it didn't cut me a ton. It just like was impact bruise. And so I had like a big spot, you know, probably the size of like a cantaloupe on my quad that was like nerve damage for like 4 months from that. I mean, it felt numb. Like you could scratch the skin and it didn't really, it felt weird, you know, like when your hands get cold or something and you scratch it and you're like, I can't really feel that. So like I slam, I like, oh, jump back up. Like, oh, okay. Get going again. You know, just forget about it. and, oh man, I like hammered that. And then I knew I had to, like, all I had to do was just keep moving. I had enough effort or enough juice left that I wasn't going to catch. And then in hindsight, like afterwards, Jeff was like, we were talking afterwards and he was like, dude, you know, he comes from like a you know, he ran in college and he's younger than I am. So he still has really good leg speed. And he was thinking that during it, he's like, I'll get him on the downhill. Right. And he said, when he came over the top and he looked down and I was out of sight, like gone. He was like, where'd he go? You know, cause he could see me on the climb. And then all of a sudden I'm gone like a ghost. And so that was like, that's exactly what I wanted to happen. Right. That, I mean, it's the head games at the front. Right. And so like, I just, you know, from that point forward, you're just like, push. You're in the lead. You're running scared, you know? And once you hit town, and I kept looking back anytime, there's no real place to really look back. But I knew when I didn't see him, I was like, it's going to be hard for him to catch me now, you know, once I got to the trees off that first downhill. But yeah, it was awesome. I mean, I have to say it was probably one of the coolest wins I've ever had, you know, and I've had 29 in hundreds. And it's probably one of the most special ones just because it's Hard Rock and it's my favorite race. And just to be, yeah, you know, just to be handed, I was bummed at first, I have to say, because of Xavier's situation and what happened, went down. But I mean, I also echo Killian during that time. I think he's put it on Twitter, like, you need to know the customs of the countries you go to and what the rules are. And our rule is DQ if you take aid outside of an aid station. I knew that. I carried 2 liters of liquid and filtered an entire liter in the creek down by the shed on the way up Bear Canyon, right? Because that's a hot section for the leaders in the afternoon. It's west facing. So it's a benefit to have aid where he took aid. And so, you know, I carried 2 liters through there, right? So, you know, it's definitely, and it's all uphill. It would be really nice to only have to carry like a half liter, you know, out of your A, instead of, you know, another 6 pounds of water or something, yeah, whatever, you know, 2 pounds per liter or whatever.
I remember as you said, it's strange circumstances, but I remember in the gym on Sunday, the sense, and every Hard Rock champion is a champion that we need to celebrate. And it was really awesome talking to David Horton, you know, the first Hard Rocker, first Hard Rock champion. But the sense in the room was, it's one of us. It's one of us won. Because you'd already been out there. You were already, you know, well known as a Hard Rocker. Your love for Hard Rock was already well known. And so, you know, sometimes you get these people that come in and, wow, amazing talents that come in and their first time they run Hard Rock, they win. Sometimes they set a course record the first time they run Hard Rock. And yet, for you, Hard Rock had beaten you up a few times and you'd taken your licks and then you got the win. And it was just this amazing feeling in the gym of one of us. It was, you know, he's one of us. And when I say that as somebody who's been very, very slowly finishing behind you in those years, but still, know that you love Hard Rock as much as we do.
Yeah.
Kept coming back after successful.
And I kind of want to add in there.
Yeah.
It sounds like Hard Rock always takes something from you. David Horton told us he had a bone sticking out of his hand. You destroyed your quad for a solid few weeks after the race. You couldn't really feel
months,
it. So
it was weird. Every time I would get a massage or something, when the masseuse would go over your middle of your quad, it was like nerve damage. Like it felt kind of numb. It was weird.
So I guess the Hard Rock course requires a physical sacrifice.
A toll. It requires a toll. Bring your coins to the River Styx. It requires a toll.
the river South Mineral, the river Uncompahgre.
Exactly
right.
So I have a follow on question about winning it, or not about winning it, but this year you were fifth male, sixth overall, and that's the person who came in before you was Courtney, with yep. her success at UTMB and stuff like that. Did you guys run together during the race at all, or were you guys together for a while?
We hung out the first climb going up Little Giant. I actually just on Instagram yesterday posted a selfie with her. We were laughing and joking on the way up. We kind of have a history of she came with her first Hard Rock the year she dropped on the counterclockwise. So that was like 2021, right? I think. Is
yep.
that correct?
Yep. It was.
Yeah, it is. It would be 2021.
Out of Uray.
Yep. So when she, that year, she at the start line had said to me, we were standing next to each other and she goes, any advice from a veteran? And I said, I gave her Rock Horton spiel, which Joe Grant had reminded me of at Kroger's. I'd gone up to scout the snow and the conditions. I always do that as a kind of a ritual every year when I go to Hard Rock. I come like on the week before Monday or something before the race, I go hike up there and check it out. And I ran into Joe, and Joe reminded me of this story that I'd heard from Rock. You know, Rock's always passing on wisdom to younger runners, and he was a mentor of mine, and he had given this to Joe as well. And one of his analogy, and if you know Rock Horton very well, everyone will appreciate this if you know Rock. He loves the details in the story. And he would say stuff. Now I've come up with my own story and I've put my own spin to it, but it's basically paraphrased from him. And that is, imagine the race as a artisan piece of sourdough bread, of sourdough toast. And you have you are the knife. And you have one slab of peanut butter on that knife, and that's your effort. And you have to put a smooth spread of that peanut butter over the whole piece of toast. Now, don't lay it on too thick early, or you're going to have dry toast at the end. You don't want dry toast. So I passed that on to Courtney at the start line, exactly how I just told it. And she said, if I'm going too fast, just yell peanut butter. And so I said, fair enough. But she was so far ahead of me by Pole Creek, I couldn't even yell peanut butter. She was too far in front of me. And so she blows up. I see her on going up Camp Bird Road. She's in the car coming down from dropping out. Okay. And tells me she hasn't, you know, she's been throwing up and like hasn't been feeling, she's out. Right. And so anyway, I continue and finish. And the next year, she comes back, 2022. And at the beginning, we're talking again. And I go, remember peanut butter. And she said, oh. And I said, I have another observation. I said, you've been in front of me two times in hundreds, at Western States and at Hard Rock. And both times you dropped. And so she held her finger to her nose and went, oh, and pointed at me. And so she went out behind me the whole time in 2022 and ran a course record. So afterwards, we joked about that, right? That, you know, basically my observation was correct and that she ran a course record, right? So then 2023, we're standing at the start line and we're talking about it. Or no, we didn't even talk about it. I think we might have said peanut butter jokingly or something at the start line, but you know, whatever. And at that point, Dylan Bowman's in on the toast analogy. So he's like, I don't want dry toast, you know, and no dry toast, spread the peanut butter. You know? And so that's getting passed around the start line, you know. And so at this point, we all take off. Courtney and I are together. She actually passes me on the rolly stuff down low. And then we get on the climb and we all come back together and we're climbing up the road and talking, everybody's chatting. We're in a little group, about a group of four or five of us. And so we're chatting and she comes up next to me or I come up next to her, right? I've caught back up to her. She goes, Jeff, I just want you to know I know my place. She goes, I just need to stretch my legs a little bit on the lower part. And I said, you know, I'm getting old. And at some point, you're going to have to go in front of me and fly and be free. And so we were laughing about that. Well, I snapped a picture of that. When we were laughing and talking about that, I did a selfie, you know, because now I have my phone with me, right? Because I always have the GPX route. another lesson. And see, I'm tying all that in here. I'm a coach. I got to tie it all.
Well done. Well
bringing
done.
It back full circle. So he ends up. So she, anyway, we end up together. And then she, I'm ahead of her out of Cunningham. And then she catches me in Pole Creek. She always runs Pole Creek better than me. Like, she is so good at she's just a really good runner. She has really good quick cadence, amazing, just cruising. And she kind of leaves me, right, out of sight in Pole Creek. And then I'm thinking, well, maybe I'll catch her later, you know? And of course, I never catch her, right? So after the race, I just came up and said, when I finished, she came up to talk to me and I gave her a hug. And I said, as I was hugging her, I said, fly, be free. And she goes, no, I don't want to fly, be free. It was a good little joke. So we have an insight. We have our own little jokes that have gone kind of year by year. They've expanded in depth, but that's kind of the background. And that was the story from this year.
That's awesome.
That is fantastic. Jeff, the reason we started this podcast is we really wanted to capture these types of stories. Really all the stories, as you said, you got a story from Rock and there are stories that I'm sure you heard when you first started coming out to Hard Rock from some of the old timers. And now we're getting to be those old timers that are sharing those stories with other folks. And so this podcast is about capturing those stories and making sure that they're recorded and that people that are interested in Hard Rock can hear them and learn from them. Is there any other story about something that's happened to you or that you've heard happen to somebody else during Hard Rock that you want to make sure people hear?
I've got a couple of more stories from Hard Rock. There's always good stories out of Hard Rock. I've got kind of two that I could kind of pull out of my memory quickly.
Yeah, please do.
One is expanding on the story we already started with being pinned down in American Basin, the gear stuff we were talking about in 2014 with the storm that hit. And that was the year Adam Campbell and his pacer got their battery knocked out. One of them got their battery knocked out. They were going right over the top of Handy's when the storm hit. And I was down in the basin, me, Coop, Kabaragi was behind me, and then Diana Finkel was behind him. And so we all kind of came back together where we were hunkering down, waiting this lightning storm to move out of the basin and to move off of Handy's. It looked like Zeus was on top of Olympus and like throwing lightning bolts, you know, do not come up here, you know, I dare you. And so we sat. It was 70 minutes total for me on the clock, where it was 50 minutes in that one spot where we hunkered down. I still call that Lightning Rock, where we hung out. It's right where American Basin Trail and the trail that comes up and over from Grouse come together and tee, and then you continue on up to the lakes. Right there, there's a slabby rock just above the trail. That's where we were hanging out. And so we waited. I mean, it was flash booming all around us. You know, it's dark, pouring rain. And so it finally kind of quit raining hard. And as it kind of moved off, at that point, Coop had moved out, went back to a tent of a backpacker that had been at a backpacking tent. Okay. You saw it in the night, right? It was just getting dark when we came through American Basin. It had just gotten dark. And I remember looking over and seeing a tent like 40 yards off the trail, a backpacker tent, you know, like two man, three man, maybe a small three man. And I remember thinking, wow, that's weird. I never really see tents up here, you know, that often. So like, just remember it. And then I got over there and Coop and I were hanging out. So I came up on Coop and he was already hunkered down and he goes, I'm not going up there. And I go, good point. And so I hunkered down with him. And then, you know, Kabaragi catches up with Justin Angle pacing him. And I knew Justin from Patagonia Ultra Running Team. So Justin and I have known each other for a long, long time. So we start talking. Kabaragi doesn't speak in English, right? He's the race director for UTMF. North Face athlete. And then Diana Finkel and her pacer show up. So we have a little party going on at this Lightning Rock, you know? And so we're all hunkered down there getting poured on. I'm like, my teeth are just chattering uncontrollably by the end of this 50 minutes. I am so cold. I'm soaked. My double Houdini is soaked. So the only thing that's keeping me warm is my own body heat radiating back into the jacket, right? The water, the windbreaker. And so I'm just freezing. And finally, at some point, I don't remember how far into this 50 minutes, Coop bails back to the tent. He's like, I'm going back to that tent, man. He only had a Houdini jacket. That's all he had. Short sleeve shirt, Houdini jacket. That was his only layer. Okay. This is back when we didn't even have good vests yet, right? Or anything. Yeah. Like, we had the bigger packs if you're going to carry something. So a lot of times you just carried, like, you know, stuff around your waist or something, you know, and two handhelds. So like, I had a pack at that time. So I was carrying a pack. I'd been working with Ultraspire. So I had like a prototype pack I was working on for UTMB. So I was kind of testing at Hard Rock in 2014 before I went to UTMB in 2015. So he bails back to the tent. Now I got a side story on Coop, and this is told through Coop. So this is out of my memory. So it might be a little wrong, but I'll tell it as best I know how. Coop goes back to the tent. Okay. This is, I think, the first or second year that weed is legal in Colorado. He pops his head in this tent, right? There's two dudes really baked and with a bottle of Southern Comfort that's half gone. Okay. So they're drinking SoCo, smoking some weed in their tent. You guys know Coop. He's big, right? He's tall. He's got kind of a commanding voice, right? He's a head coach, you know? And he like sticks his head in there and just starts giving them directions. I need to get out of these wet clothes. I need a sleeping bag. I need that, you know, I'm hypothermic, you know, and like starts ordering them around and get in one of their sleeping bags. Okay. So now he continues on. He gets warm enough and the storm moves off and he eventually moves on over and tries to warm up at a couple of the aid stations, right? But never at Burroughs, and then goes on down to Sherman. I think he ends up dropping because he never can get warm after that. So he's hypothermic enough. Now I had just enough layers that I didn't get hypothermic, and but I was cold, right? I was fighting, like trying to stay warm. But so after 50 minutes, right, Coop's gone. So it's just me, Kaburagi, and Diana Finkel and their pacers. So we go. Diana being from there, she's like, we can go on up a little farther towards the lake and it's still protected. And we were like, yeah, let's move. You know, I just wanted to move. I was freezing. So after the race, my jaw was sore from the chattering. So we go up to there and we're standing in slushy snow, looking up at Handy's, you know, we're just below the lake. So you got to climb a little more up to the lake and then you got to traverse, right? And then you got to do the, you know, Handy's proper. And so we're looking up at Handy's proper from that little bit of creek that comes out down there and that little tiny basin below the lake and sitting there going, you know, all of us, every time it would lightning and we'd wait for the thunder and we go 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, you know, out loud. And it would be like 2 seconds. Then it was like three seconds. Then it was like 4 seconds. And then we all were like, when it's 7 seconds, you guys okay? We're all going to go. And Diana, of course, is super impatient. So she's like, okay, at 7 seconds, I think we go, you know? And like, okay. So, you know, and I was like, yeah, let's do it. 7 seconds. That sounds good to me. Seven's like my lucky number. I'm good with that, you know? And so we're waiting. Finally, we get to that 1,007, you know? And we're like, let's go, you know? And so we all take off and I don't have a pacer. I just have my poles out. I just want to get warm. I am so cold. So I take off like a bat out of hell. I mean, I'm like, pulling, trying to get warm, getting my heart rate up, you know? And I'm also thinking, I got to get the heck over the top of this thing, you know? I don't want to get struck by lightning. So we like, I'm the first one to the top. We summit. I'm about 80 meters in front of the group. I can see their lights, but they're kind of together or pretty close together. I'm by myself. I go over the top and right off the top of Handy's, you go off a little couple, two switchbacks, and then it kind of flattens for about 40, 50 yards. And then it drops off onto the knife ridge where it's super rocky and steep. And I'm just coming off the top and light. And remember, it's dark. So we're just under the headlamp, right? Lightning strikes the point that I'm supposed to go off of. And he's like, boom, right in front of me, blinds me. I hit the ground, hands and knees, don't even think about it. Like, it's full submission mode. Like, oh my God. And then I jumped up, and I don't know where this came from. Old wives' tale. I was a farm boy. Lightning never strikes in the same place twice, even though I know that's BS. But that's all that came into my head. And that I had metal. So if you guys notice these black earrings, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. These are custom glass blown earrings. Okay. I had them custom made after 2014 Hard Rock because I had metal, stainless steel, stretched hoops in my ears. And that was the first thing I was thinking about as I took off after I said, lightning never strikes in the same place twice. I'm fully bent over, like with my poles, like spears in my hands, and I'm running as fast as I can, bent over. And I'm thinking, you've got metal in your ears and you're like a lightning rod. Get the heck off of this mountain. And I remember just going, God, God, I don't want to die. I have kids. I have kids. I don't want to die. I'm a dad, you know? And so, and this is 2014, right? So I have like a 12-year-old. And like, at this point, I have a 12-year-old at home. Hold on. I have a 12, a 9, and a 1-year-old at home. Oh. No, 4-year-old, 3-year-old at home. So I'm like freaking out. My wife, you know, I'm the sole breadwinner. She stays home with the kids and homeschools them. I'm like thinking all these thoughts are going through my head. In the 50 yards, I have to sprint to the end of the mountain and jump off. And I have my poles out. I'm a skier. So I have my poles out like a skier. And I was literally double hopping the steps down. I'm just like, got to get off this mountain. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. You know, I don't know if you guys remember. Sorry. If you don't remember the movie Gulliver's Travels, the cartoon. There's the little kid, the little town crier that goes around the whole thing, you know, all's well, you know, okay. One of the things that happens when he first meets Gulliver, Gulliver picks him up and he goes, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I got millions and millions of kids. You know, like that's playing in my head. I got millions and millions of kids. I don't want to die. And so I'm like going down that thing and I'm like jumping over stuff, over boulders and like, throwing because that you go down and switch back into the scree, and then now it's more of a trail. But back in 14, it was more of a scree field. It was kind of a trail, but it wasn't like the Hard Rock Trail we know today, right? And so it has enough traffic, you know, that it's more improved. But back then, it was really crappy. It was actually kind of route finding through that thing, you know. And I just remember like there were snow sections, and like I was jumping over stuff, and like I got down into the tundra. And I remember there just being a boulder, like a rock, big rock that I could sit on. I came into the grass. I was like, you know, and I sat on the boulder. I like dumped all the scree out of my shoes. I'm sweating by this moment, right? Two Houdini jackets on and Houdini pants. I shed the Houdini pants, throw them into my pack, get the scree out of my shoes, dump them out and put them back on. And I remember looking up. And all their lights were just coming off like the ridge, like they were on the ridge. And I remember thinking, I'm out of here. I still had, you know, still got to go a ways down a tree line in Grizzly Gulch. So I'm like just hauling down. I mean, just jumping stuff, hopping, just, I got to get to the trees. I got to get it. Cause the lightning was still going off every once in a while. You know, it still was like, and it was moving the direction we were moving because it was moving north. Or north northeast, so it was like right in. It was still above Grizzly Gulch and down in Burrows. So like I remember just like hammering until I got to the trees. Once I got to the trees, it was kind of like, oh man, I think I'm in the trees now. Okay, good, you know. So that was a crazy night, insane night, you know. Okay, that's story one.
I gotta catch my breath after story number one.
Oh man, I can't remember if this was 16 or 18. So one of the two in the counter on the clockwise direction. So I'm in the Pole Creek area. Okay, so where it's all kind of cascading downhill, following the drainage, and you're working your way downhill, it's kind of rolly downhill. And you're traversing and it's a side slope to the right. So you're looking up a slope and there's some rocks stick out and brush and other stuff, but it's mainly kind of meadow, it's above tree line. I just remember, I don't even remember what, every time I run that section, I look for the section where it was, and I still don't remember exactly where it is. But at that night, I just remember there was something kind of dominant, whether it was a tuft of meadow or whether it was a rock. I don't remember. But all I know that I caught movement out of my headlamp, out of my peripheral. So I start walking because I'm solo. I don't have a pacer. I'm by myself. So I start hiking and I look and I'm walking and looking, and there is a mountain lion stands up, and there's another mountain lion laying down next to her. So I'm assuming like an older full grown sibling, or not a sibling, a daughter or something, right? It's two mountain lions, both full size. One looked bigger, but I couldn't tell for sure because the one's standing up, one's laying down. But it definitely wasn't a baby. It was just two big, two full-sized mountain lions. What the dominant one, obviously, stands up and walks like five yards as I'm hiking, paralleling me, above me. I mean, we're talking only like maybe 40 yards. So wow. I immediately flip, face the mountain lion with my lights and blind it so it can't see me moving, because it can see me moving when I'm walking sideways, right? It can see my silhouette. So I've come in contact with mountain lions before. I have a history of being in the lead at 100 milers, and I've jumped up in two other times. I jumped up mountain lions and had a pretty close face to face at San Diego 100. There was an even closer encounter where we had to yell at it. Really, like, it was me and Jesse Haynes. He was pacing me the last 20 miles. And so I'm looking up, and I face her, and I start just yelling and like beating on my chest like Tarzan, and like saying, "You want any part of me?" And just going freaking full psycho. So I don't know if you guys know this, but there is an old National Geographic film of they follow this lion pride around for a bunch of episodes. And this lion pride comes in contact with this chimpanzee troop in the Serengeti, right, where it's kind of scattered trees. And anytime the lions are in their vicinity, the chimpanzees, all the mommies and babies, go up the trees, and the males stay down on the ground, and they flare all out, and they throw sticks and rocks, and they just literally go, ape blank, the old saying, ape sleep. I'll keep this good, so in case my kids listen to it. So that's in my head. And what happens in this chimpanzee lion thing is that basically the lions, you can tell their posture is like, these guys are crazy. Like, I don't think we want any part of them, So that's what I'm trying to do this mountain lion. I'm like, I'm crazy. Don't mess with me, And so I yell at it a bunch. And then I go backwards for a while. And luckily, wherever it was kind of an outcropping where the trail kind of curved. And pretty soon within 40 yards, I couldn't see them. So I was out of sight. And as soon as I got to there, it was like 40 yards backing up. I like turned and took off. And then I would like every 40 yards, I kind of skid to a stop and start hiking and look behind me and scan and do a full circle 360, make sure no eyes, no glowing eyes, nothing's tracking me. And then I would take off again. And I did intervals like that for about 4, 5, 6 times until I didn't see anything. And then I was just like, it was all downhill. So I'm like running hard. And back where you get to that aid station, you come down to bottom of Pole Creek. Now the aid station's down to the left or whatever. Well, that was back when it went straight up to the aid station, so you could see it up on the hill, up on the knoll. And I like got down to that section. I'd run hard for like 20, 30 minutes, and I got to there. And then you start hiking, and I started thinking, okay, I'm out of danger. And then all the adrenaline like rush goes away. And then you're just like, oh my gosh, I'm so tired. So those are some two Hard Rock stories that are pretty gnarly.
That's amazing. Thank you. That is fantastic. And I'm now I'm terrified to run San Diego.
The beauty of running at night is you can see them. Their eyes glow at you. So you're like, what the heck is that? Oh my gosh, that's a mountain lion.
Chris, if you didn't catch this stipulation, just don't run off the front. There you go. At night,
this is the thing. Flush everything out, man.
Thank you. On behalf of those of us that have never finished faster than 35 hours, thank you for doing such a great job of flushing out all of the bad things at the front so that the rest
and
of us.
Spider webs. You get rid of all the spider webs, everything. Too. So we thank you for that one.
It's a breeze. Finishing later in the run is a breeze. It's easy. It's easy. You follow the footprints and the snow and all that. It's great.
Yeah, right.
Sir, thank you so much. Congratulations to you on your success at Hard Rock and at all the other races, all the other runs. We really do appreciate you. Thank you for being a part of the Hard Rock family, and we'll see you in Silverton.
Thanks a lot, guys. Have a great day. Giddy up.
Hey, everybody. We hope you had as good a time listening as we did recording this episode with Jeff. These are the types of stories people are passionate about telling, and we again hope you had a great time listening. We also want to thank Smartwool for being a longtime partner of the Hard Rock 100 Endurance Run. Thanks for joining us, and please tune in again next time. That's when I'll sing my song.